Welcome on to a Tuesday night edition of the Dunked On Basketball Podcast. Probably our third classic game of these playoffs, going back to Boston, Washington game two and Memphis, San Antonio game four. This game five between San Antonio and Houston, an absolute stunner in overtime with Kawhi Leonard on the bench. San Antonio takes it. We're going to give you the audio from our Twitter NBA post game show to talk about that. Then we got to get into offseason previews for the Atlanta Hawks and the Brooklyn Nets. A reminder that we are sponsored today by Texture. Texture.com/capspace gives you 14 days to try them for free. And ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter.com/capspace allows my listeners to post jobs for free. I also want to remind you guys, check out the new Dunked On video. First one just posted on my YouTube account. I've been tweeting it out. It's a fun syncing of our Twitter NBA show audio with the key moments of the game. We did that great San Antonio and Houston game as our first one. So check that out. People have been giving it some good reviews already on Twitter. I hope you can give that a look. And it's also a nice advertisement for what it's like to follow along with the Twitter NBA show live version. But here first is our audio from the Twitter NBA show postgame. Welcome on to the Twitter NBA show postgame edition. After a classic game five between Houston and San Antonio, a valiant San Antonio win without Kawhi Leonard in the lineup down the stretch. If this is your first time watching, what we're about here is an alternative to the normal kind of fluffy postgame shows where we're going to get deep into advanced analytics, advanced play breakdowns, give us the same sort of analysis that you come to expect on the Twitter NBA show, and also take your questions as well. If you have them, hashtag Twitter NBA show is a great way to lead those, or we'll interact with people live on Periscope as well. So Danny, your takeaways from this win without Kawhi Leonard, that seemed like the big key to me, that they won without him.
It is. And so Kawhi Leonard was dealing with a knee issue earlier in the game with his right knee, and then he returned to the game. He looked okay from that. That wasn't really there. And then he sprained his left ankle, landed on, or was kind of trying to pivot on, and landed on James Harden's foot. And he tried to play on it, but then he couldn't continue at the end of the game. And the Spurs were able to rebound. They lost the lead a couple of times. They didn't score, and I think it was the first 3 minutes of overtime, but they were still able to win the game and control to inform of the series, 110-107.
Yeah, they desperately had to have this game, especially with the Kawhi health situation, right? I mean, you have to imagine if he couldn't go at the end of this game with only one day off in between the game six on Thursday, they would have been facing a closeout game with him at the very least highly limited. Now, I mean, if it were me, he's not even seeing the floor in game six. I'm just going to let him get healthy, come back for game seven, and see if you can win that on your home floor, because I don't see any way that he's going to be 100% by Thursday. Maybe he can get to 100% with four straight days off.
I think that's a very good point. And your goal is to win the series. Your goal is not necessarily to win game six, now that those are not one and the same. They would have been otherwise. But another place that I think we have to go early on in this is Houston's offense late in this game. They, despite doing a wonderful job, particularly in the first half, of attacking early in possessions, of course, it also helped, like, David Lee and Kyle Anderson were on the floor early in the game. They did not play late. But Houston was waiting too long, whether that was Harden's fault, his teammates' faults, the coaching's fault. We don't exactly know. They were getting started too late, and that allowed the Spurs to crash in, because it's a lot easier to figure out what a team's going to do with 5 seconds left than with 15.
Houston's late game offense has been a perpetual problem in the Harden era, and while their offense is outstanding for the first 43 minutes of the game, late it's just Harden holding and holding and dribbling, and maybe he gets a switch, but then he's still going to hold it a little bit longer, and then he's going to dribble a little bit longer, and even when he has the switch, he doesn't go early enough, because you got to go early, attack, get in the lane, and then if you're going to drive and kick, you got time to actually do that with the defense at a disadvantage once you force up. Far too often, you end up with James Harden just holding it down to the end, and then it's so late in the clock that once he finally does decide to go, he's just got to take a tough step back three-pointer, and while he started 4 out of 10, he missed his last 5 three-point attempts of the game. Really, none of them were good looks, and it was so frustrating because, you know, on the Twitter NBA show, we're saying over and over again, they got to go earlier, what are they doing, why are they waiting? And then the two times that they actually did attack early in the possession with high screens very high up in the floor to get Harden going downhill with some kind of alacrity, they actually did get really good shots.
Yeah, they got a corner three from Patrick Beverley, which was the first basket made in overtime, and then I can't remember exactly what the other one was, but I remember
Anderson corner
that's three, right, yeah. Anderson corner three, and
those were their only 6 points in all 12 overtime.
And they also didn't even go quickly when they had a 2-for-1 opportunity at the end of overtime.
Yeah,
they were
that's
just,
right.
They were sitting there. They had, I think it was like 34 seconds on the shot clock. And so you're going, okay, you know, you get it early. If San Antonio is going to do what they're going to do. Instead, they burned it until like 20-something seconds. And it was infuriating in that way. Some stats from that end, from the last 5 minutes of the regulation to overtime, Houston shot 4 of 11 from the field. Only one of those shots was a 2. The other was 3 of 10 from 3. And they turned the ball over 6 times. They had more turnovers than made shots.
Yeah, and a lot of that was Harden going one-on-one, but also got to give some credit to the Spurs defense, especially even without Kawhi Leonard, was outstanding. Jonathan Simmons in particular, he had 2 just pokeaways of James Harden. He just was fighting over screens, getting on his back, getting back around him when he did get screened, and it really was an outstanding effort from him, a coming out party of sorts. We've seen the flashes from him at times, and what he was able to do defensively, not fouling Harden as well. Harden only took 8 free throws in this one, and they had good help as well. Harden would say he was fouled on a couple of those plays. Simmons drew the offensive foul late in regulation on him. Monte Ginobili had a key block. Danny Green had some big plays at the rim, switching
out.
Patty
Mills had some really nice defensive possessions throughout the fourth quarter and overtime. We got asked in the middle of the game, you know, how's Patty Mills a defender? I feel better about him after this game than I did before.
Yeah, he had the key steal late as they were going for a 3. They actually had someone else besides Harden attack on that play. It was Gordon, and Mills cut him off, forced a turnover, and then was able to draw a jump ball that wasted a bunch of their time, and then they couldn't really get into anything after that either. So it was really just a fantastic defensive performance late from the Spurs, and it was such a struggle, a defensive struggle in the fourth quarter and overtime. You forget that this game, like, these teams couldn't stop each other in the beginning, but once Kawhi went out, it really, that was the last chance for San Antonio. They just had to devolve into LaMarcus Aldridge posting up every time, and he had a massive struggle. He was 7 of 21 from the field, also 4 of 7 from the foul line. He missed 2 key free throws late, but he was incredible on the offensive glass to the tune of 9 offensive rebounds, and some of those were really key.
They were extremely important, and I believe the Spurs had 5 offensive rebounds in the last 5 minutes in overtime, but amazingly only had 2 second chance points. But when you think about where this game went, that's still important with the way that it turned out, and they had more second chance points overall. But my issue with some of the LaMarcus possessions, and a lot of this did come when Kawhi was more limited but still playing, was that the process was flawed. Like, they were just kind of feeding him the ball higher, deeper out than you would really expect, further out, not deeper, and he was sometimes settling for shots. He did have some really nice moves. He had that step through that on Clint Capella, who I thought did a wonderful job defensively for the most part in this game. And it's hard to figure out where the Spurs are going to go if Kawhi sits, because you think about it on the defensive end, because in the defensive end, you know, he's defensive player of the year candidate, a big part of their success. But offensively, especially without Tony Parker, he creates so much of what they do.
Yeah, I think they actually have the horses with Green and Simmons to guard Harden okay. Although Harden is actually, like, really hard to stop when he doesn't just hold the ball forever and ever, for eternity, forever. Some of the big key plays in this one, Manu Ginobili tied the game to send it in overtime with 34 seconds left in regulation. A tough drive past Clint Capella on a switch after they did a good job reversing the ball to him. Then they got a switch over there. He was able to go left against Capella. Clint Capella probably doesn't know the Manu Ginobili scouting report the way everyone used to, that you got to make him go left. But I thought, as I said on the Twitter broadcast, I was like, oh, this isn't going to end well. Like, Capella's got the advantage on him. And Manu, just such a cheeky finish with the left hand speed layup, never put the right hand on the ball, snaked it around him. It was a beautiful play to tie it. And then both teams just had horrendous end possessions. Houston, as you mentioned, could have gotten the 2-for-1. They didn't. Harden just held the ball. They never even got him in the middle of the floor. They never even tried to get him switched against a big. And then he just drove right into Simmons, who cut him off and drew what I thought was a justifiable offensive foul. And then the last possession of regulation wasn't any good either, Dan, with Mills having to take an impossible shot that he didn't even get off.
And Pop was yelling at Pau Gasol, who might have messed up the play. It looked like he might have been supposed to screen for LaMarcus Aldridge. So you had that circumstance. And then Mills didn't have much of an advantage, but he kind of double pumped it, and he shot late. And it actually happened in both regulation and in overtime that a shot went in after the buzzer, because Mills' shot went in, but it was too late, clearly too late. And then I think it was Eric Gordon or Patrick Beverley just chucked one up after Ginobili blocked Harden on the last play of the the game, and it went in too, just the way this game went.
Then at the end of OT as well, I mean, and we'll do later on Dunked On a full breakdown of all these plays, but Houston, Danny Green with a really tough three off of, I think it was an offensive rebound by Aldridge. It wasn't an offensive rebound. I think they just swung it from the right wing, actually, and it was an incredibly tough shot because he was just backing up, and he had to take it 3 feet behind the line, like getting your legs into it while you were backing up right before the shot is really difficult. So he switched that. Then he had that incredible and one drive after Ryan Anderson had hit a corner three to put Houston up. You thought that might do it finally for this gallant Spurs team. And then Manu Ginobili with the huge play blocking James Harden's tying three at the very end after Mills had stripped Gordon. It was really just great clutch play by some Spurs players who may have been a little bit more out of the limelight now with Aldridge and Kawhi really taking on more of the scoring responsibility. But Aldridge, you know, forcing him to his right shoulder. He just couldn't make a right shoulder turnaround to save his life the entire game. And it was really just those guys stepping up and making it a rock fight was important.
Something else big picture that I thought was significant is that we saw this actually in the first half and then it continued throughout the game. San Antonio was getting into the restricted area a lot. Some of that was through their offensive rebounds. They were getting putbacks and some of those were going in and some of them weren't. They were 23 of 40 in the restricted area. Houston, for comparison's sake, was 18 of 27. So that's a pretty significant difference.
Yeah, the Spurs also really won the turnover battle, and Harden was brilliant early, had 23 points in the first half, finished with 33, missed a ton of shots late, and had 9 turnovers. A lot of those were really bad. And then the Spurs, despite the fact that, you know, some of their best guys weren't really playing well or available, only had 7 turnovers for the game. And so Houston really, you know, they got the shots that they wanted to get. Mostly, you know, they took very, very few shots. They took only 8 shots from floater range and 3 from mid-range, 11 long twos the whole game. And yet they still weren't able to be that effective. And another problem is just Houston stopped hitting their three-pointers. The first quarter, the teams were 6 out of 12 and 4 out of 8 on threes respectively. And then nobody could hit a three until Danny Green hit the one late. But Houston 16 out of 48 on three-pointers for the game.
Something else that ended up being significant later on was both teams didn't foul that much during regulation. I think it was something like 15 to 15 earlier on. But then the Spurs fouls were all decentralized. Nobody had more than 2 going into overtime, whereas the Rockets were only on a few guys, and that ended up impacting the game because Ryan Anderson picked up a 5th foul and then nearly picked up a 6th foul. And I thought that kind of got him off balance a little bit defensively. And also Harden had 4 and Capella had 4. They both could have gone in different directions too.
What do you think of Pop's decision to start Patty Mills, who finished with 20 points on 7 of 16 from the field, 4 assists?
He's the reason, well, a big part of the reason their offense was so good early, because they couldn't hide anybody. You know, DeJounte Murray did pretty well attacking when they weren't paying attention to him early in game 4, but Patty Mills converts that into buckets and converts that into threes. And Kawhi wasn't scoring much early, but part of that was because of the attention that he was generating was going to guys like Mills.
Yeah, and Mills was very aggressive with his shot, to the point he was taking some bad ones at times, but considering some of the other struggles that they had, I think him being aggressive really worked out well. I thought fatigue was a factor for Houston with Harden, but he played 43 minutes, which is not a ton for an overtime game, but I thought he definitely was out of gas late. That's probably, I mean, I think half the reason he holds the ball so long is that he's just tired. I mean, and you know, the guy does run a pick and roll on every single Houston possession basically when he's in the game, so that's understandable. But he also runs less in terms of like miles per hour than any perimeter player in the league in general, and that's I think has continued during these playoffs. But both fatigue and foul trouble too. I mean, Houston played 7 guys with Nene unavailable, and Anderson, he was great, 19 points, 7 of 11, but Eric Gordon was 4 out of 13, although he definitely had some moments. But I think once Harden couldn't create open three-pointers for all of them, as he did in the first half, it really, they don't have much. It's just because if you can stop Harden one-on-one or two-on-two, then those guys can't get open, and that turns into a game that the Spurs are much more comfortable with.
As crazy as it sounds, considering how much their personnel has changed over since last year, the basic concept of how to defend the Rockets isn't that different. You know, you want to defend the pick and roll 2-on-2, make sure, and if the other guys beat you 1-on-1 with a contest, so be it. The players that they have supporting are more capable of doing that, and they have more guys that if they get a blatant mismatch like Lou Williams and Eric Gordon can attack it. But when it, especially with the way they're running their late game offense, it's not that different.
No, I don't think so. And, you know, from the Kevin McHale era to the JB Bickerstaff era to the D'Antoni era, you think that maybe the common denominator there is Harden. Megs 34 asks, why not play Harden off the ball some? He's not good at it, because if you're going to play off the ball, you got to run. And every once in a while, they I think one of their first plays of the game was trying to run him off a screen and get him on the move. And I think that could be useful, but D'Antoni doesn't really do that much off the ball stuff just in general. He's much more just high pick and roll every time. And then Harden, just, you know, that level of running is just not something that he does.
Harden is also much better with the ball in his hands than without the ball in his hands, and he's not good when he's being denied. So if you open up that opportunity, especially if Kawhi or Danny Green is on him and they can execute the scheme, like, remember that play with Eric Gordon? I don't even know if there had been a pathway for him to get that ball back. I mean, he would have gotten it maybe deep in, like, kind of towards half court, but they can do a good job executing that.
Yeah, let's see if we got some questions here using the hashtag Twitter NBA show. How important was Ryan Anderson's foul trouble? That seemed to limit the Rockets going small. Anderson did play 36 minutes, so not that much. I mean, I think more important than his foul trouble, he ended with five fouls, so I think he got his fifth in overtime or very late in regulation. The bigger problem is just that he didn't start each half, and so you can only play so many minutes if you don't start the half.
And that certainly can lead to fatigue in a different way, because even though his total minutes aren't there, if you're not getting the rest, it can be a real challenge. And I think that was a limitation for them. Also, if you're not moving the ball, if you're not generating those opportunities, he is not providing nearly as much offensive value, even though he did make one of their two shots in overtime.
Yeah, I mean, he obviously is spacing the floor, and he shot incredibly well. Just, you know, they weren't able to get him quite enough attempts. Should also mention the game that Patrick Beverley had, 20 points, 6 of 10 from the field, 5 of 7 on 3. So he was outstanding. Played some pretty good defense as well, despite getting what looked like a foot contusion as well. I mean, but this game, I think by the end, it basically, and we'll give Greg Popovich credit, even with Kawhi Leonard out, he still went small. He just acknowledged that every moment that they had Ryan Anderson at center, they just couldn't go big. And the Spurs started to learn how to play that way a little bit more. They switched more. They were able to get more penetration off the dribble than we'd seen before, take advantage of Houston's lacking help defense, especially when Anderson was in the game at center. I thought when Capella was in at center, they did much better. Capella had some really nice intimidations and shot blocks at the rim. He was a big reason why they shot so poorly at the rim. But good job by Pop going to that and not saying, oh, well, Kawhi's out, we got to go big again. You know, that never would have worked. And also the other adjustment I liked was Kyle Anderson and David Lee both got smoked in the first half. And so he just pretty much excised those guys from the rotation in the second half. I thought that was a key to their victory as well.
It's also important to note that if they had excised them entirely from the rotation, as much as they were flawed in their minutes, maybe their guys would have been almost as gassed as the Rockets guys were. I mean, you did need someone. Maybe it could have been Bertans or DeJounte Murray or somebody like that, but they need somebody to fill that role. And playing seven guys is just probably not enough, especially when you consider the high intensity, other than the last few minutes of the game when they dragged, of a lot of this time. I mean, there was a stretch at the beginning of this game, I think it was the first like 5.5 minutes, there was the only stoppage was one pretty quick foul that was not a shooting foul.
All right, let's see what else we have. Given the Spurs' lack of athleticism inside, should Harrell be a part of Houston's rotation? I've said why I don't think that, but do you agree with me?
I do. He's not providing enough surplus value, and if he was a little bit better of a screener, maybe you do it that way, but they don't even, I don't think.
Well, but he's imminently switchable is the problem too, right? Here's the problem with Harrell. He gives you all of the disadvantages of a big guy and none of the advantages of a small guy, because they don't really need him to be like a switch guy at center. He does get on the offensive glass a little bit, but the Spurs are a great defensive rebounding team. I don't think they're going to have a huge advantage there. And then the big problem is he can't guard anyone in the post. He's too small to guard Gasol, not to mention Aldridge. And so if you're going to have a pure center out there, you better not be able to get posted up. And then he also is a poor defensive rebounder as well, which is another problem against this Spurs team that really has been effective on the offensive glass. And you'll note that in the three Spurs wins, over 40% offensive rebounds game two, over 40% offensive rebounds game three, and 32% in this game after they only had two in the first quarter. They continued to dominate, and we mentioned what Aldridge was able to do, and good on him too too, for, you know, even though he shot 7 out of 21, finding a way to make himself useful. And he must have been exhausted too, having to guard and pick and roll all day, and then also, you know, going into the post all the time and bodying around there to still be able to get those 9 offensive rebounds. Really impressive from LaMarcus. Let's see what else we got here in terms of questions.
We got asked if the Spurs should run, especially if Kawhi's out, more LaMarcus pick and roll, because they got better looks on that. And I think they did, because there were times when Houston switched it, and that was when LaMarcus could really press the advantage, especially because Houston, when they go small, other than Eric Gordon, who's strong, a lot of their small guys are really small.
Yeah, Beverly, Ariza is a little skinnier. Yeah, I think they haven't run nearly enough LaMarcus pick and roll or pick and pop in this series, and especially once Kawhi is out of the game. I mean, what else have you got really as far as that? And now, by the way, I mean, we mentioned that we didn't think the Parker injury was that big. Now it's big, because if Kawhi is going to miss time, they really are going to need someone else who can do something off the dribble. I mean, Manu played 32 minutes. John Simmons, like, those guys were having to attack off the dribble. You know, I don't know if they can repeat their performances in the next game. So it'll be interesting to see what the reports are on Kawhi.
There actually is something. Michael Wright has said apparently that Kawhi said he's playing in game 6, though I'm always a little bit dubious of those at this point, because you have to see how the swelling goes and everything else, and there are elements of this that we don't know yet. It's possible, and you can listen to that. It's a piece of the equation, but it's not the whole thing yet. And I believe Kyle Lowry was optimistic about that, and then he missed games 3 and 4.
Yeah, well, I haven't seen anywhere on Twitter yet whether Pop just decided to take Kawhi out or Kawhi felt like he couldn't go. I think it was the latter, to be honest. And I think it was the former, that Pop did just take him out. I mean, Kawhi looked very anguished on the bench. I mean, more angry than like sad, I thought. And hey, you know, I mean, it worked. It wouldn't have been my choice. I would at least have had him out there for the last possessions where, you know, you're not going to ever leave Kawhi Leonard. And so Kawhi says he's playing game 6. I would be very wary of doing that if I were the Spurs. And if anybody can be counted on to take the long view, even in a series like this, it would be San Antonio. I mean, the thing is just, even if he's healthy, they're underdogs in game 6. So why compromise your chances in game 7 when he's probably not going to be close to 100%? And maybe, you know, he'll try and warm up or whatever and give it a go. But if he doesn't look absolutely perfect out there, which I think would be a surprise given that he couldn't finish this game. I mean, usually you're probably better off on these ankle injuries finishing that game than you are a couple days later, with Markieff Morris the notable exception. See if we got any other questions here worth hitting. I think that's probably about... Oh, yeah. So, is LaMarcus at all capable of additional scoring if Kawhi's ankle is worse than expected? Asks Spencer Gilmore.
I don't think he... I mean, maybe some more of his post-ups will go in, but as a pick-and-roll player, certainly he can take advantages and mismatches, and I think do it that way. But I don't think you want to just feed him.
I mean, that's what they did in that fourth quarter. And, I mean, he's got to shoot better on right-shoulder turnarounds than he has so far. He's shooting like 10% on those, but I mean, that's the scouting report, obviously, to make him go to his right shoulder instead of his left. And, you know, I think he does have to get deeper position, but it's tough to ask you to do that if you're taking 25 shots out of the post every time. But it does at least slow the pace down. I mean, they do have that to say, hey, you know, when he takes a fadeaway jumper, they're probably not getting a fast break out of it. And I think that was important. There are only 20 possessions in the fourth quarter. Neither team scored very well. And you say, especially if Kawhi is going to miss time, turning it into more of a defensive slowdown struggle would be the way to go for San Antonio, even if they're going with a lineup that's mostly small guys around Aldridge. Let's take two more here, and then we'll call it quits.
Who is the best option for Houston to at least get to an 8-man rotation? For me, it's Sam Decker.
Yeah, I think so. Maybe his hand is still bothering him, and just, you know, if you watch him shoot in warmups, he just can't make a shot or something like that. But I mean, I think he at least should get some modicum of time to see whether he can be another option to kind of spell everyone. I guess another thing Houston might consider is, do they want to just start Anderson and Capella together just to get like 3 or 4 minutes there, and then you take one of those guys out and alternate them throughout the rest of the game, just so you have Anderson able to get a few more minutes? I mean, he only played really 31 minutes in regulation, essentially. All right, one more here, and then we'll call it quits. What's Simmons' potential? Well, it's limited by the fact that he's 27. If he were 23, I'd be like really high on him. But You know, I think he could be a very solid rotation player. Maybe not a good enough shooter to be a starting two guard, but especially as an option who can go small, finish around the rim. The harassing defense that he played on James Harden was outstanding today.
Plus, the dearth of wings around the league. I mean, just need a rotation caliber wing is incredibly useful. And we should note that he is arenas limited, which means that because of his, he's only been in the league for 2 years, which means that teams cannot make an offer for more than the non-taxpayer mid-level exception.
To start with, they would be limited to that for the first 2 years, and then you could go up as high as the max the next 2 years. So I doubt that he would get close to the max that he could get, which would still be something crazy.
It's gonna be sad if he gets less than Boban, but it's probably gonna happen.
he could get a big offer. I mean, I'd rather spend my money on him than a lot of guys, we'll put it that way. Okay, before we move on to Brooklyn, I want to tell you about our friends at Texture. I used to love magazines, but then I became a bit more ecologically conscious, and I started reading them every once in a while online. But you don't really get the same feel as you do the normal magazine. You don't get the layout. If it's on a tablet, it's not really the same thing. There's no table of contents. It's not in order. But now with Texture, not only do you not have to subscribe to the paper version, but you can get over 200 magazines for what it used to cost you for a monthly subscription, only $9.99 a month. Sports Illustrated, Men's Fitness, ESPN the magazine, more highbrow stuff as well, like The Atlantic. And you don't even have to take my word for it, because you can check them out at texture.com/capspace to get a 14-day free trial. That slash capspace URL, easy to remember because we talk about it all the time in the program, as we will for Atlanta and the Brooklyn Nets very shortly. Why would you subscribe to just a couple of magazines when you have all of your favorites all the time for way less? Again, that's texture.com/capspace. Start your 14-day free trial, and then it's a mere $9.99 per month after that for access to over 200 magazines. texture.com/capspace. So we thought, Danny, that the Atlanta Hawks would be at a crossroads at last trade deadline in 2016. They held on to Al Horford. They lost him in free agency. We thought that the Atlanta Hawks would be at a crossroads last trade deadline in 2017. They did not. They held on to Paul Millsap and all their outgoing free agents, except for Kyle Korver. And now the time has come, perhaps, to pay the piper for that kind of short-term thinking.
Right, because they have this combination of players that are already on their books. They gave Dennis Schroeder an extension. They also signed Dwight Howard to a three-year contract. And now they have other players, most notably Paul Millsap and Tim Hardaway Jr., that will be free agents.
Well, the big problem for them is they're just not that good, you know, and I thought that they were seduced by that because there were reports that Paul Millsap would be, in fact, be on the trade block. He then was not. And part of the reason for that was, oh, we just won like X number straight, you know, 8 in a row or something. They started the season 9-2, but their point differential wasn't any good. And they ended up finishing the season in the fifth seed, but, you know, 2 games basically ahead of eighth, and had the worst point differential of any team in the playoffs. And so, number one, what are you trying to keep together? And number two, how much will it cost? And number three, even if you pay as much as you possibly can you keep it together, especially for Paul Millsap, who you have to imagine, even at age 32, continues to play well, will have some suitors for the max.
The difference between an opposing team's max and the Hawks' max is also important here, because it is a lot less of a risk to give Paul Millsap 4 years with 5% raises than to give him 5 years with 8% raises, or even less than that. You know, if giving him, let's say, 5 years even at the opposing team's wages would still be a lot, because he's 32 right now.
Yeah, he is. So, it would be a little bit of a risk to pay an undersized power forward $46 million when he's 36, 37 years old. That would probably... not a particularly enticing scenario, but this is what the Hawks have left themselves set up for now. And who knows, maybe the offers that they could have gotten were just so piddling that they figured they might as well keep him around. But it seems pretty clear to me that this team is not keeping together. And similarly to how we talked about Toronto last year or last night, but even more so, I mean, Toronto, at least you're keeping together a 50-win team for a couple of years. This is keeping together. I mean, if they just keep everyone on this team, I mean, let's say they just bring that back, this exact team. Like, let's just pretend. How many games are they going to win next year? 40?
Yeah, around 500.
I mean, maybe you could say, maybe you could say Schroeder takes a step forward. He's young. They can get more out of guys like Prince and Hardaway. Bazemore will bounce back a little bit, but Howard and Millsap, arguably their two best players, probably on the decline. So, I mean, hard to imagine, and they were lucky this year. You know, if they have the same point differential next year that they did this year, they're a 35-win team probably. So I would expect them certainly to win less games, and now you're not even making the playoffs probably, and you've got Paul Millsap Millsap on your contract at 40% of the salary cap, basically, for the next 5 years, or, you know, even if they get him for less, even the next 4 years, it really just doesn't make sense to me. But you feel now they have such sunk costs with having kept him, with having lost Al Horford last year, that it's like, you know, I fear they're just gonna like pay what it takes for to keep him. And I think considering that they're not that good, you know, I think there are plenty of other, unlike Toronto, you know, with like a Kyle Lowry, for example, or Utah with Gordon Hayward, or the Clippers even with Chris Paul, where it's like hard to find another place where they're likely to be on a better team. Paul Millsap has a ton of places that are likely to be better than the Hawks over the next 4 years. So it's not like Atlanta can say, hey, maybe we can pay you a little bit less and you get to stay here and stay on a winner.
It's also not the only team he's ever played on. So you don't have that yep. case, which they had with Al Horford. You know, that, hey, this is your team. We're the ones who drafted you. I mean, it is true that Atlanta, though it was a different general manager, helped really revitalize Paul Millsap's career, but he was a good player when he left Utah. He just became an all-star after he left. And the other element of this that I think is so important is that my instinct is that another team is going to save the Hawks from themselves, because as you said, the money might not be the same, but he's 32. They've made the conference final. I think he's made the conference finals once in his career. If the Hawks aren't going to be that team for the next couple years, then why is he going to commit to it?
Yeah, and I still don't think that they'll offer him the full 5 year max. And maybe I could be wrong. I think, like, I have a bet with Tim Bontemps actually that whatever contract Paul Millsap gets will not be the most he could possibly get from whatever team it is. That even if it's a team like Denver or something, that maybe they don't pay him the max. I mean, that seems like the most logical suitor for him. But the good news, though, is that they have a ton of stability in the front office with an established GM who's been there for a long time and really knows the team's personnel and has a great system in place right now.
Are we on crazy pills all of a sudden? Is that what's happening now?
Yeah, they've got this turmoil, right? Wes Wilcox may or may not remain with the organization. I expect him to go the Sam Hinkie route. Mike Budenholzer, in theory, is going to be stepping down. There have been a number of candidates who've been discussed there, from Joe Dumars to David Griffin. And you imagine Griffin rumored to be their top choice, as he is with Orlando. Cleveland's season isn't even going to end until probably like mid-June at the earliest. And that's the first point they could even talk to Griffin. His contract doesn't expire until the end of the season. And you have to imagine, too, that he's probably going to just return to Cleveland, that Dan Gilbert will pay him enough, but he's not going to want to leave there to go to the Hawks or the Magic, probably. And then they've got another candidate potentially coming in. Like, when is he going to come in? Or are they going to give up on Griffin as well? Griffin's not going to tell them, hey, I'm not interested now through back channels, because he wants to keep them around for leverage so he can get more money from Cleveland. Or if he doesn't, then have an out. So I see this whole situation dragging on for quite some time. Now, Wilcox and Budenholzer have been doing this for a little bit, so maybe they just do whatever they are going to do. But I mean, do you want to come in as a new president when the guys ahead of you, essentially on July 1st, are making a decision, or the guys who were there ahead of you, are you making a decision that could cripple their cap? Because if they re-sign Millsap, they're going to have no cap space at all. If he leaves, they'll only have like $25 million, and they won't have any cap space for like 3 years after this either if they re-sign him.
Plus, you have two other voices in the room that have the trust of ownership, at least to a degree, to hire them in the first place and then not fire them. So you get into the too many cooks issue, you get into a power struggle issue, all of those things running together, and it would be a perilous job. There are people who are willing to take perilous jobs. I'm not sure David Griffin is one of them, and he shouldn't be.
Yeah, that's right. I think if you're Atlanta's ownership and you're dead set on bringing in someone else, that you need to do it now and give up on this pipe dream of Griffin. I mean, I think any reasonable observer would say, like, what, there's a 5% chance that Dave Griffin would come there, even if you back up the Brinks truck for him, and that, you know, if Troy Weaver is a candidate, or Dumars, who, you know, I'm not sure why he would be a candidate, frankly, given his record down the end in Detroit. You know, I'd probably rather have Wes Wilcox, frankly, than him. But just based on, you know, what their records have been over like the time that they've been in the league, So yeah, I mean, they need to move now if they're going to do this. Like, they need to move like yesterday. We're a month away from the draft right now.
And we should also talk about, I mean, we focused on Millsap for a good reason. Millsap is the most compelling and significant free agent for them, but he is far from their only important decision because Tim Hardaway Jr. is a restricted free agent. So he has a pretty low cap hold. They can kind of play it by ear with him if they want, or they can try to be proactive. But they also have a pretty critical mass of other free agents, and all of the other guys are unrestricted. Mike Muscala, Ersan Ilyasova, Tabo Sefolosha, Chris Humphries, Jose Calderon, and varying levels of bird rights, as you would expect from the Atlanta Hawks. But those decisions are really complicated too.
Muscala in particular, I think, is someone who would be in demand for me as a center who can protect the rim okay. Not a great rebounder, not a great post defender, although he's gotten better there, but can shoot the three. I mean, as a backup center, I think he's totally useful. I mean, he was closing games over Dwight Howard in the playoffs at times. The advantage with him is that he does have that extremely low cap hold, but if you're going to bring back Millsap, that doesn't matter. And if they do bring back Millsap, I mean, we talked about the mediocrity that they'll have. If they bring back Millsap, bring back Hardaway, now you're starting to even think about the tax, you know, and then, you know, if you wanted to bring back Ilyasova, that assumes they waive Mike Dunleavy as well. He's non-guaranteed, or he's guaranteed for $1.7 million out of the $5.2 that he's owed for next year. So I don't know. I mean, like, if they're going to bring back a lot of these guys, and then they have their draft pick, obviously, also coming in, they would be, like, close to the tax. So they're not going to re-sign all these guys. Sefolosha, another guy who, I mean, they probably should let him go because they want to get Torian Prince more time. And so I don't know. I mean, let's say, give me your order after Millsap. Who are you prioritizing the most in terms of bringing back?
Muscala, because
over Hardaway.
Well, I think Hardaway is different because he's restricted, so you just can play him by ear, so you don't prioritize him. Also, I have faith in their ability to develop perimeter players, and Hardaway, as a restricted free agent, his offensive potency leads me to think that somebody's going to overpay him. I don't know who it's going to be, but that's the same sort of thing we saw with Allen Crabbe. A talented player plays a position of value, does something that other teams value, and they get overpaid.
Yeah, and Hardaway already 25. So he's not exactly incredibly young here. I mean, I think Muscala can be pretty good, but we do think that there are a lot of backup centers that are available, but not a lot of them are great shooters. So that's a concern. Tabo, like I said, wouldn't be a huge priority for me. I mean, what would you be willing to pay Mike Muscala if you're the Hawks? They do have full bird rights on him at least. And this is assuming that Millsap sticks around, because that's scenario A. Scenario B is Millsap leaves, and then I think you're in just like total fire sale mode if you're smart, but they may not be smart.
Right, and fire sale again is complicated because you can still bring Muscala back at the right value. If my instinct is something in like this, starting at about $7 million range, but I think somebody's going to offer more than that.
Yeah, $7 million for like maybe 3 years rather than four.
Yeah, that's about what I'd be comfortable with.
What about Hardaway?
Oh, I mean, talented offensively. We saw him. Was that against the Rockets, that crazy game that he had, that fourth quarter?
Yeah, where he had like 20 points in the fourth quarter and they won on the road. I mean, I would say that Hardaway, to me, his defense has gotten a little better, but I think it's still pretty bad. I mean, he got torched by Bradley Beal pretty badly. No thanks to Dwight Howard's pick and roll defense as well on that, but not really any good at getting over screen, which is one of his primary jobs, and not big enough to switch either. He's a one position defender at the two. And I mean, I would say that he's not as good as Terrence Ross. Would you agree with that?
I would agree with that, yes.
And Ross got, you know, a 3-year, $33 million extension from the Raptors, a more perhaps a fiscally prudent organization. And the Hawks have been a fiscally prudent organization until recently. So yeah, I mean, I think I wouldn't want him on my team for more than like, you know, 3 years, $21 million or something like that, you know, but they may think more highly of him. They, of course, traded the number 19 pick in the 2015 draft to get him to the Knicks. But outside of him, and let's say now that Millsap, and Millsap technically has to opt out, which he's obviously going to do. He's due only $21 million with a player option, so he's in line to get over 30, so he's clearly going to do that. What happens if they just lose Millsap? Either they don't want to pay him enough, or he just decides he's going to go elsewhere.
I think then everyone goes on the market, and I don't know how that works. Dwight Howard is intriguing, I think, for some teams because he does have that defensive value, at least in concept. His pick and roll defense was definitely concerning in that first round series. Schroeder's complicated because there's a reason, whatever it is, that they gave him that money. He does have kind of a high ceiling if he can figure out the
he played pretty well in the playoffs. Yeah, I'll give him that.
And
at least with his own individual statistics, they still didn't really play that well with him on the floor.
And then Bazemore, I think that there are teams that could be interested in that, you know, a guy who could defend both guard positions, hopefully can hit open shots better than he did this year. His contract isn't great, but it's not horrendous or anything like that. So maybe you can make all that work, and you are dependent a lot on offers. But the other part of this equation is that in all likelihood, you would want to move quickly on selling those guys, because as soon as teams start getting out of the cap space world, then you're losing potential suitors unless you're going to take back money in return, which the Hawks could be open to. I don't think they need to just say, oh, we need to maximize every scrap of space we can get, but it does narrow the field in a way that is concerning.
They certainly feel that like they can't rebuild in this market, but I mean, if we're being honest, they've been in the playoffs for 10 straight years, and it's not like they've been like capturing the team. Maybe the 2015 team is the only one that did capturing the town. I mean, if you've been in the playoffs 10 straight years, like, it's unrealistic to expect to stay there for that long unless, you know, you have like an absolute superstar. I think it's actually, considering the lack of superstars that they've had, that's an extremely impressive accomplishment for them to have stuck in the playoffs for that period of time with some very different cast of characters. But I think that time is about done. Maybe they could fight for the eighth seed next year. I don't see that happening. If they lose Millsap, I think you have to blow it up, because just you're not going to be good anyway. And so you might as well just try to move on from Bazemore, try to move on from Howard, even if it's just pretty much a dump for like a second rounder or something, and just start playing the young guys and see who you can develop. And then you just move into the, all right, let's see if we can get some young restricted free agents, take flyers on guys, take on bad money from other teams and get some draft picks. I mean, that market, I think, of taking on bad money from other teams is one that is going to open up significantly now with the cap starting to freeze and all that awful money from 2016 around. So that's probably the strategy, you know, tried and true. But and at least they still would have Schroeder is like theoretically kind of exciting, or like Torian Prince, but not a ton of excitement on the scene. But let's go back. I mean, that's sort of an easier call. What do they have in terms of draft picks this year and in the future?
This year they have 3 picks: number 19, number 31, and number 60. Just a quick thing on 31. That is actually connecting the two teams we're previewing today. That is a pick from Brooklyn from the Joe Johnson trade in 2012 that is conveying now.
Oof. Yeah, and 31, a lot of people might say, is more valuable than some of those late first rounders due to the greater flexibility that you can have with those.
Then on top of that, they also have, in the future, they have a lottery-protected first from Minnesota that could convey as soon as next year if they make the playoffs, and then a top 10 protected pick from Cleveland that probably will convey in 2019.
Do you think there's any chance that they could like re-sign Millsap and just try to get like Paul George or Jimmy Butler with the assets they have, or is it just not enough?
I don't think it's enough. I've had various Blazers fans try to pitch to me. They're like, oh, we could trade 3 of our like non-lottery first round picks for Paul George. It's like, no. I mean, you need premium assets to get somebody like Paul George, and especially from Indiana, considering his importance to that team. And you don't see that. I mean, even if you go back to the Harden trade, they got a better pick than that, and Lamb was intriguing, and had been a first round pick that season, and then Kevin Martin was a talent too.
So let's say they hold on to Millsap. They're going to be limited at best to the full mid-level exception, maybe even the taxpayer mid-level exception if they're just like being careful. What do they need? I think the number one thing that pops out to me is they just need someone else other than Schroeder who can do something off the dribble on this team, get to the basket and finish. Even Schroeder is not really a great finisher. They also need somebody who can pass. They don't really have any good passers on this team. And then also, I think a backup 4 and really a backup 5 as well, depending on what happens with the Muscala.
The really uncomfortable part of this for the Hawks is that there aren't many guys, of course there really aren't many guys for the mid-level exception, that can do that rudimentary dribbling and also shoot, because Dennis Schroeder isn't a reliable shooter at this point. If you want to play them together, you can't have that bad a spacing backcourt. It just won't work.
Yeah, but in that price range, finding someone like that, you know, that's like a $25 million a year player.
Right.
And I mean, and also, by the way, I mean, we can think of how screwed they'll be if they lose Millsap. Like, this is why they need to rebuild. I mean, if they lose Millsap, they'll have $25 million in space, and they'll basically obviously need probably an upgrade at backup point guard, potentially. Malcolm Delaney's okay. They're still going to need someone who can do something off the dribble. And they'll have precisely like one rotation front court player as a big in Dwight Howard under contract. So really hard to imagine that they can really do. I mean, if they lose Millsap, it's not like they can really sign anybody who can come close to replacing his production. I mean, this will be, if they lose him, they're going to be the worst offense in the league, probably, unless there's just a massive step forward from someone like Prince, that where he can like do stuff off the dribble, which we don't really expect at all. But let's say if they're keeping Millsap again, Tyreke Evans on a make good contract could be someone they could look at. Deion Waiters might be a guy as well, but he'll probably actually be out of their price range, frankly. Same thing with Patty Mills and Derrick Rose. Rodney Stuckey is a bargain basement guy who can maybe create some shots. Like Aaron Brooks, just to have somebody who can like throw a shot up at the rim and expect it to go in every once in a while. It's just that they are really limited as far as their ability to add to the team with or without Millsap.
And only having the mid-level exception would also likely take them out of the real interesting restricted free agent range. Like, I even think Ben McLemore probably, you know, he's probably at the range there where if you're giving him the mid-level exception, Sacramento probably matches that.
It's really interesting to look back on their 2016 offseason, which I actually thought was okay. I was like, all right, you know, Dwight Howard on that contract for this team could be better than Al Horford. That probably wasn't the case. And Howard certainly looked like he was quite wooden in the playoffs, looked better at times during the regular year. But between $23 million over the next 2 years each year for Howard, and then Bazemore making an average of $17 million over the next 3 years with a player option on the end of that, I mean, that's like $40 million in just way more expensive production than they can expect to get this year, and I think any other year going forward. So even them, who we thought like didn't do too badly in the 2016 offseason, they did badly because they signed any free agent at even close to the market value.
And did so
and for that's, and
a
that's
long
why
time.
They're in this predicament now. But, you know, they couldn't handle the idea of just kind of taking a step back or trading Millsap as well and just kind of starting the rebuild back then. Because the problem is, even if they want to start the rebuild, they still have to move Bazemore and they still have to move Howard to even get back to having some modicum of salary flexibility that's really going to make a difference for them. So it's really, they probably should have taken their medicine last year. They definitely should have taken it at the trade deadline this year. And now I think because of that, you know, it's difficult for me to see how they don't have anyone on this team that's a future star. You know, I don't think they have anyone that you would look at if they lose Millsap. There's nobody on this team who's at the top 15 at their position in the NBA. Like, how depressing is that?
Moreover, either of their free agents or of other teams, who's going to take a discount to join this team? And when you think about building, you have to consider that sort of thing. So the way they can get discounts is by finding guys and developing them. And Atlanta has done a masterful job of that in recent years. You know, Bazemore, they functionally picked up off the scrap heap. They got discount contracts from Millsap twice. And the Dunleavy, I think, has done a nice job for them. You know, I think they deserve credit for that. Torian Prince drafting him. I think he's looking like a talent for them. But again, that's not really a free agency thing in the traditional sense. And also remember that value free agents might pop up a little bit this year. But really, they're kind of going by the wayside, especially when you're thinking about more long-term deals, because there still is a fair amount of money in the league.
All right, we're going to get to Brooklyn momentarily, but first, this from ZipRecruiter. The way to get started with them, ZipRecruiter.com/capspace is the URL to post jobs for free. Why would you want to post jobs on ZipRecruiter? Well, because you only have to do it once instead of doing it 97 times on all of these industry-specific websites, social media, Craigslist, anything else. That's what I used to have to do when I was working as a lawyer and we would try to get some other candidates in. I would have loved to have had ZipRecruiter. It works for any industry, any city, nationwide. You just post once and you watch your qualified candidates roll in. You can interface with all of them through ZipRecruiter. You don't have to juggle emails or calls to your office, sign in to 8 different services or more than that, and remember all the passwords. You can quickly screen candidates, rate them, hire the right person fast with ZipRecruiter. That's why they've been used by Fortune 100 companies and thousands of small and medium-sized businesses. The way to get started with them, and of course, let them know that you came from us, which is important, ZipRecruiter.com/capspace, which again, we talk about so much here during this offseason preview time, ZipRecruiter.com/capspace. One more time, try it for free, ZipRecruiter.com/capspace. I kind of feel better about Brooklyn's future than I do Atlanta's in some ways.
beyond the whole not having their pick next year thing, you know, and Atlanta has a much better pick situation. I have completely adopted something that you threw out a while ago. I think it was around this time last year. The idea of approaching Brooklyn solely on the lens of 2019-20. The logic behind that being they don't have their own pick in 2018. So that's it's unprotected.
Feldman was actually the first one who came up with that on the on last year's mock trade deadline. When 2016 mock trade deadline, when he kept like trying to make trades and like just couldn't do it, and it became this huge joke. But that was actually his plan that he articulated. So
Sorry, Feldman. But so the idea being that, and that is the way that I would approach everything for Brooklyn, really. And obviously that is not an all encompassing thing, because you can do a lot that doesn't directly conflict with that. What's so shocking about that compared to what we just talked about with Atlanta's books, all Brooklyn has for 1920, so three seasons away, is Andrew Nicholson's player option, their rookies from last year, and then a cap hold for then restricted free agent Rondae Hollis Jefferson. Other than that, they're wide open.
Oh, that's not all they have, Danny. They have $5.5 million owed Darren to Williams. Darren Williams from stretching him.
That's right.
Oh God,
that's buried in my sheet. I didn't even think about it, but it's in there.
I know. Well, yeah, I saw that too. I'm like, why is the number so high? And then I scrolled down to like my dead salary section. I was like, oh, that's right.
But so,
and I think even go ahead. Sorry, I was gonna say 2018-19 even. They've got nothing on the books really then either. They would have $65 million in space. Even if Jeremy Lin opts out, then you're probably almost over $75 million in space with the expiry of contracts to Brook Lopez and some of this other dead money. Remember, they were like way under the cap this year too. I think they were $10 million under the cap this year, maybe a little less than that because I didn't put in some of their like 10 days and stuff for this year. But right now, though, this year, again, I think that's an interesting point. I think for 2018-19, I don't want to be too good then. I want to kind of be bad. But for this year, go ahead and be good, you know, because both of their picks or their pick is owed to Boston outright, and they don't even have the swap rights this year. They have $25 million in space. The only real variable, they have almost no free agents. The only real variable is KJ McDaniels. He just finished his third year in the league, and they have a team option for him. So they can either decline that option and make him a restricted free agent now, at which point his cap hold would go up to a little over $6 million, or they can keep him under contract for next year at $3.5 million, but then he's unrestricted at the end of that. But basically that would make a difference of, you know, between 25 and 28 million or so in the amount of salary. And you know, the question becomes here, how much do you want to commit for later? And I also think that, again, considering that they're trying to build, that they don't want to be too good in 2018-19 when they actually will finally have their draft pick for once, and they need to still get some premium talent onto this team. I think they should probably do their best to just keep, you know, like $15 million in space open, because, I mean, what good is being that much better this year? I mean, maybe you try to sign some guys, but it's just not really that exciting. And they have so many holes still that I don't see them like getting close to playoff contention this year unless they can really hit on that $25 million. But $25 million sure doesn't go as far as it used to, especially when you have as many holes as this team. What do they need as far as just like trying to get better?
Almost everything.
I wouldn't say that. I mean, point guard, center, I mean, I think Caris LeVert is and just kind of other like scoring guards are good, but forwards, I mean, they don't have any. I mean, I guess they got Rondé. You know, he can be one of your forwards. So they probably need like a power forward who's better than Trevor Booker, who actually had a nice year last year, but he's on the downside now at 29. They really need a backup point guard, especially, I mean, you just saw how bad it got when Lin went down. And then, you know, maybe a backup center would be nice as well. Justin Hamilton, probably not quite good enough to play a good backup center, but they've got Quincy Acey. Maybe they can cobble something together there. So, you know, if they could get like a pretty good forward and maybe just overpay someone for next year, because then, and there's also, you know, the possibility of maybe trading Brook Lopez. He's in the last year of his deal making $22 million, but doesn't really seem like any potential suitors for him because, as you talked about, the center market is so impacted right now.
How are you feeling about their flotilla of non-guaranteed guys? So they have a series of different...
I think they should keep almost all of them. Unless, you know, I mean, they'll have to probably cut a couple of people just if they're going to make new signings. But I like all those guys reasonably well.
I don't love Joe Harris personally. I never really have.
For the minimum, he was good last year. He shot like pretty well on threes.
He's all right. I mean, but the problem with them is they're also adding two more first round picks, and just I think that you can wait a little bit. And also the other benefit that Brooklyn has, considering they're probably not going to spend all their money, is Big Whoop. You keep him around because he actually guarantees early. My notes have him guaranteeing, you know, right at the beginning of free agency. But Big Whoop,
he and Sean Kilpatrick are both right. June 30th. But yeah, I mean, Harris might be a guy that they could look to move.
Sure. And so you just kind of go through it and you say, okay, well, what's the worst case scenario? And yeah, maybe he's not good enough to make your final 15-man roster. If that ends up happening, first of all, that's a really good sign for where they're going. But second of all, you could do that. Nobody really cares. I'm also not the biggest fan of Archie Goodwin, but Archie Goodwin has a later guarantee date. His is around Halloween. So then basically that's trading camp.
Yeah, and even only 200 guaranteed after that. Archie Goodwin, actually, like, if you just look at his stats, he played pretty well. He had like a 65% true shooting percentage last year in pretty limited minutes. But I still think there's enough there, especially on this team, where the one thing they do is spread the floor pretty well, and they just need guys who can do something off the dribble. I think he actually, like, I would keep him around and, you know, see how he looks in summer league and that kind of stuff. But I think, like, I'm not ready to give up on him yet.
I'm not either. And, you know, he's at the minimum, so it's not a big deal. And so you work from there. And the idea, and I agree with you on the idea of kind of, if you can't get guys for the kind of the equivalent of the Hinkie special, where you're signing them for, you know, discounted rates for a long time, I would consider, you know, giving somebody maybe less money per year, but like 4 years for a player who might not get that long anyway, just on the prospect of eventually having them on some of these good teams. I don't know exactly who that is, because the problem is the guys who hit unrestricted free agency just aren't young. Like, I wouldn't necessarily do that with like Ian Clark, but
yeah, I think with some of these guys, like some of these guys who've been like okay, like a Sean Kilpatrick or a Joe Harris, maybe if you can find a way to roll those guys over for a second rounder, and those guys are under contract for just this year, but then I think they would both be, I don't think either of them would be restricted free agents.
No, Kilpatrick is in that place where if they had structured his contract differently, because he is, this will be his fourth year, the next upcoming year. So if it was structured as a team option, they could have theoretically declined that and made him a restricted free agent if they had wanted to, but they can't do that now.
Would you decline KJ McDaniel's option and make him a restricted free agent, or would you just keep him under contract for next year?
I don't think it makes that much of a difference, but I think I'd pick it up just because the idea of getting him as a restricted free agent, just for the idea of maybe him picking up his qualifying offer or just getting a really low value, I think that's a little bit too cute and there's no real point to it. Giving him $3 million and just seeing if it works out, worst comes to worst, you cut him, who cares?
Yeah, that sounds good to me too. Now let's say they did want to add to the team a little bit. I mean, you obviously want to get young guys. You want to get guys who really, because we said, you know, they probably need a tank in 2018-19 still. You either want to get guys who could be tradable on value contracts or who would still be around and contributing in 2019-20. Who falls into that category as a free agent who also, I mean, because they do have one nice asset, which is they got playing time because they're bad. And so you can help a guy maybe who hasn't been playing as much increase his value, and then you can move on from him. Nikola Mirotic is someone who comes to mind there, that maybe, you know, something along the lines of just pay him like a starting power forward, give him a $15 million a year offer and just see if Chicago matches it or not. He would be a great fit in their system. Just let him bomb away, let him do some more stuff off the dribble. I think Cristiano Felicio as a backup center kind of falls into the same category, and you could even do like offers for both of them and see who comes in. Milos Teodosic, who we've talked about to some degree, that he's been linked to the Nets. I'm not sure why they would prioritize him when they already have Jeremy Lin. I don't see him wanting to be a backup on a bad team. But maybe he's already 30, so not much point of him unless they wanted to move on from him. Some of the other guys that you might look at is kind of like rehab projects or guys who could just give them something at forward. Omri Caspi, of course, was another guy that might be undervalued. Brandon Rush could be a guy who just would give them some shooting and some modicum of defense on the wing as a two-way guy. They just don't really have anybody who can defend and shoot on this team. Luke Babbitt is a backup for Jeff Green with yet another one-year overpay comes to mind. Tyler Ennis as a backup point guard project. Maybe Shelvin Mack could be someone they could bring in as just like a steadier backup point guard who, if Jeremy Lin misses time, like, he won't just absolutely kill you. He's got experience as a starter. And Luke Mbamute could be another guy too, who at least will play some defense on the wing and really upgrade there. Him and Rondé, you'd never score probably, but you know, you kind of got Brooke Lopez for some more spacing, and maybe you could actually stop people in those scenarios.
I feel like the better use along those same lines is actually instead of signing free agents to try to acquire players from other teams. And there are two broad angles on this. One is to get straight up just garbage assets. So toxic assets, yeah. You could go in a
Andrew
couple different
Nicholson,
directions.
Just do that trade again.
Do that sort of thing again. And another benefit that they have is that they can get 2 years of bad money. I would not be looking at the Dang and Mozgovs of the world unless a team really bowled me away. I would be looking more, a guy that I thought of was Omer Asik. Asik has 2 more years and then a partial guarantee for $3 million. I don't know that the Pelicans are going to be looking for cap space or that they're necessarily asset rich, but those are the type of players that I would be looking for. And there will be a team that is desperate to clear space. Somebody's going to go somewhere and they're going to be, or the team's just going to be fundamentally optimistic. And so you want to be the go-to for that. And they have enough leverage where they can say, you know, we're not going to go beyond that season. We're not going to take 3 seasons bad money unless you do something ridiculous. And Brooklyn's a great place for
taking on a third season, even and you know, it would have to be a king's ransom to take on someone like Dang. It seems like the new market basically is for every $20 million in bad contracts you take on, you can get a first rounder, you know, kind of mid to late first rounder, and maybe an asset going back as well. That kind of seems like the new math. It used to be like $10 million in bad salary equaled a first rounder. I mean, I actually like trading for Dang to me wouldn't be the end of the world. Because if you could get maybe like one of the Lakers' young guys with him and then like, you know, a first round pick that's not that heavily protected, you know, in like 2020 or something from the Lakers for that would be, I think actually no, 2021 would be the first one that they could trade, which would be pretty crazy, or 2020 if they don't keep their pick this year. But if you could do that, I think they actually could rehabilitate Dang because he could just play at the four there. There'd be plenty of spacing. And then maybe, you know, if a contender wanted him, he would be willing to just like take a buyout next summer and you could save a little bit more money there, and then he could make that up by signing with a contender. Or, you know, you could trade him and take back, you know, someone who's making like $8 million a year in dead salary instead, where you kind of rehabilitate him so he's not as toxic as he is right now. Oh, by the way, we should add this too. Dang apparently hurt his pectoral weightlifting after the season was over. That's why the surgery is scheduled for right now, since we were asking about that yesterday.
Yes, and I can't remember who sent that to us, but appreciate it. So I don't know off the top of my head exactly who is going to be who, which teams that's going to be. So another guy, actually, I did think of this one as a potential, maybe not toxic, but near toxic asset. If Dallas really wanted to be aggressive with their cap space, they don't really need Dwight Powell anymore. Maybe they would do something. And then the other group,
he could
be
a backup center option for this team.
And then the other family of things are not necessarily toxic assets, but teams that are just desperate to clear money and take, you know, 60 cents on the dollar. So Toronto could be in that circumstance if they choose to go after, you know, if they choose to go after some of their bigger fish. There are, I'm trying to think, I know there are a few. Oh, Denver maybe with Kenneth Faried, depending on what they want to do with some of their
Faried
stuff.
Faried would be an okay fit with them too.
Sure. And so those types of players, and again, that could also be the idea of rehabilitating where you just get them for cheaper. Maybe they help you, especially in this year, it doesn't really matter that much. Help you, that's great. And then at that point, Faried's a great example of this. Then they're an expiring contract. Maybe somebody's interested in them.
They've been rumored to potentially be a George Hill suitor. Does that make any sense to you?
No, he's not gonna be as good when they're good. So yeah, I mean, that's why the idea of focusing on 2019-20 is so important, is that they're not providing any surplus value between now and then, because you're going to be awful next year in all likelihood, and then you want to be awful the year after.
Well, and remember, Hill, he's expecting to get more than what Utah offered him, which was 3 years and as much as $88 million, essentially, in new money. So even if they offer him all of their cap space for 3 years, that's not even that much. And then they would have to go to a fourth year, and that makes so little sense for this team, for the 31-year-old George Hill. It really, like, you just, like, signing anyone to something for longer than a year that's going to be a potential bad contract, just no way. Maybe it could go into, just no way, because you don't even want to be good in 2018-19. We'll see if that's what their philosophy is, but I mean, I think you just, you have to, I mean, because it's going to be hard to have that kind of discipline, right? And I know that, I think I admire Prokhorov accepting that, finally going with Sean Marks, taking on this philosophy where they're, you know, green lighting this trade for Nicholson, where they're just taking on more money. They're not trying to be good, but I mean, now we're talking about, it's been, they're in the playoffs as recently as 2015, as crazy that is to say. So they were awful last year. They're going to be awful this year, probably going to be awful next year. And then when they finally have their pick, can you really green light a fourth year of awfulness? But despite the fact that it seems like, oh, we've been rebuilding, we've been doing all this, getting all this young talent, you know, they haven't had a pick higher than this year is going to be number 22. It'll be the highest pick I think that they'll have had during this whole time.
Well, yeah, because I can't,
so you got to get higher picks.
What pick they just, got Rondé with, and that was the Mason Plumlee trade.
Oh, the other beauty of tanking next year is Brook Lopez will be coming off the books, and probably Lynn too.
Right, and the other group I wanted to mention briefly is, I think they are an exceedingly logical destination, and Philly's the other one for this. If teams that have partial guarantees want to just throw them their way instead of stretching them, like Festus Ezeli is probably the best example of this. Hey, Portland, you want to give us some middling second round pick that still has some value for Festus Ezeli, and we'll just, instead of stretching him, we'll just throw that money on this year's books for us? I would be totally down to do that.
One other quick note, the number 39 overall pick, whom they, I think, traded something significant for. I can't remember exactly what it was. Yeah, 2 second rounders, actually, for the Charlotte Hornets for the number 39 pick to select Argentinian Juan Pablo Voile. Voile, not exactly killing it in the Argentina League. He shot 15% on three-pointers last year and played only 8 games. Oh, no, I'm sorry. He played in 2 different leagues. And yeah, he shot, 26% on threes last year. They played in like different competitions. That's why I was struggling. And 58% free throw shooter. So not great for a 6'6 guard. Probably not going to be contributing at the NBA level anytime soon. Although he still is only 21 years old. Anything else you want to say about Brooklyn?
I'm excited to see if they can actually approach this as zealously as we hope. And the Nicholson trade is a really nice bright line that maybe they can, because they got good value there. I thought that was a nice trade for them. They did also give up Bogdanovich, who's, you know, helping the Wizards right now. But there are not that many. I think that there will be fewer teams using that arbitrage approach than there should be. And so that massively benefits those who engage on it early, potentially as soon as draft night.
Their big chance to do that is next year, because the cap really now is not going up next year. And with Lynn potentially off the books and Lopez, they would have so much money that they can just take on plenty of bad salary next year, and actually really, now they can really start to like potentially become asset rich for like the first time after 2018-19 season. But so that's really their big opportunity, I think maybe even more so than this season. But you know, you keep that flexibility and see what comes along. I definitely don't recommend overpaying anybody, even if it's only a 1-year deal. I'd rather just have the space to take on from somebody else. You could even like try to get an extension for Jeremy Lannister. You got a lot of things you do. So any event, I think that'll do it. Also, I want to remind you again, I talked about it in the open, but really cool thing that we did. We took the Twitter NBA show audio, synced it up with the highlights from the game. We did last couple of possessions of regulation and then the last minute 30 of overtime. And that was really fun. If you haven't checked out the Twitter NBA show yet, it's a great advertisement for that, or even just a way to relive the game. And what we're going to be trying to do with that is, we're calling it Dunked on Video. Try to get it up within a half hour after the game ends, and that's a great way to relive it like right away as maybe a substitute for some highlight shows, and get our instant analysis and commentary actually over the highlights, so you can see finally what we're talking about here on this stuff with video. Great chance to do that. We're going to try and publicize that. Not sure where it's going to end up or anything. This was our first time doing it. I got a great video editor named Nick Shibetta, who I found it on Twitter when I put that out, so Nick's doing a great job. We appreciate his help, and I urge you to check that out. I've been tweeting it out a little bit. It's just up on YouTube right now, and that'll do it. Talk to y'all next time.